Welcome to season 3 and the Christmas season and the Christmas special of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast.
And what's particularly special is that this season we're starting with Christmas.
That's right, we are this season. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I'm film watcher Greg Ralph.
So here we go. We've got 3 Christmas-themed films to talk about this episode.
Yes, we're going to start with the 2004 film The Polar Express.
Yeah, and then we're going to move to 1947, Miracle on 34th Street.
And then finish with a film that, like last year, kind of really turns Christmas on its head. So last year we did Krampus.
Krampus, yeah.
This time around we're doing the 1984 film Gremlins.
That's right.
Ricardo, why don't you tell us about The Polar Express?
Okay, The Polar Express. Directed by the acclaimed director Robert Zemeckis, famous for films such as Forrest Gump, the Back to the Future trilogy, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and A Christmas Carol, to name a few, this 2004 film is based on the beloved children's book by Chris Van Allsburg. Starring Tom Hanks, playing 6 roles here, it begins with a boy who, on Christmas Eve, is beginning to doubt if Santa really exists. Pretending to sleep, he hears his parents talk of being sad that the magic is about to end for him. The boy reads the encyclopedia to see that the North Pole is uninhabited and also sees a Santa hat in his dad's back pocket, making him feel like he's been duped by it all. That is until the sound of a loud steam train, which stops out the front of his house. Not sure if he should hop on it or not, the conductor helps to persuade the curious boy to hop on, as the train is on its way to the North Pole. In a train full of children on the same journey, we witness a boy's journey to still believe in the magic of it all. Look, the music and songs are wonderful, and the film has some fantastic sequences. My favourites being the hot chocolate sequence, whereby acrobatic waiters dance and flip, all the while setting up plates and cups and pouring hot chocolate for the children. The other sequence is when we follow a lost train ticket outside a train, into the woods, down the waterfall where it's picked up by a bird, spat out and so on, and ultimately ends up back on the train. Look, it's an awesome sequence which is best seen in IMAX 3D. This was the first full-length film to be entirely motion-captured. Motion capture refers to recording the actions of human actors who wear markers or sensors on a skin-tight bodysuit or directly onto the skin. Movement recorded with these sensors is imported into animation software, which uses that information to animate digital character models in 2D or 3D computer animation. Motion capture had been used successfully for characters such as Gollum in Lord of the Rings, but here, every character was motion captured, hence Tom Hanks being able to play 6 characters: the boy, the conductor, the train's ghost, Scrooge, the boy's father, and Santa Claus. Look, I adore this film. It's a fun ride that just does what it's meant to do and makes you feel all warm and Christmassy, which I love. Greg, I hope you did like this movie. What did you think?
Oh, no pressure. Sorry. Look, I have such fond memories of this film. I saw it at the cinemas when it first came out, not an IMAX. I'm not even sure if I saw it in 3D, but I certainly saw it on a large screen. Mm. With my now teenage son, who at that stage was about 3. And, you know, one of the treasured memories I have of that experience was during some of those kind of roller coaster scenes where it's like those rides you sometimes see at like theme parks, whatever, where you get into something and you are on that journey,
That's right.
Roller coaster, in mine shafts, whatever. And at some of those points, he had to climb into my lap and just hold on to Daddy while we watch that. So any comments I make now come with a disclaimer. Mm. And that disclaimer is, you know, warning, I can't judge this film objectively, I think, because it's so wrapped up for me in that memory.
Yeah.
And watching it again brought that memory back to me. And we've talked before about, you know, when you go to a movie at the cinema, it's not just the film. And it's not necessarily just you and your response to the film. It's the context in which you see it.
Of course.
Who you go with, whether they enjoyed it, were you on a first date or with your 3-year-old son or whatever. Mm. So I really love this film, and part of what I love about it is the experience I had in seeing it. But I think you're right. In a lot of ways, this film is really a ride rather than a film. And even that's not quite right. You know, it has a very strong story. It's got a really sound concept. It's dealing with something that our next film, The Miracle on 34th Street, right. also deals with, which mm-hmm. is just belief.
Yes.
And fantasy and imagination and growing older and so on. It's got a really sound story, but there are, I lost count of how many sequences there are where you're either on a ride in various contexts or you see these very kind of cinematic sequences. And you mentioned The Ticket, which yes. I particularly remarked on. But there's another one with the pin.
Yes, that goes, that's right.
That's used for the brake of the train,
for the
is
brake
it?
Of the
that
train,
That goes flying
yeah.
out, and they do exactly the same thing pretty much, which is the train where everything's happening and the main characters are recedes to the background and this object almost becomes a character and you follow it while it does whatever it does and then somehow ends up back at the train. But it's a strong story as well. So I like it. I have some problems with it.
Yeah.
But I really like it.
This is really interesting. You say about the context of when you see it. I first turned this on before I was a dad.
Yep.
And I turned it off.
Oh. Well, and how did you watch it? On TV?
Yeah.
Yep.
On TV. And I was on DVD.
Yep.
I got it. That's and I thought, I mean, I'll watch this and I'll see what it's like. And I found because I had an interest in it because it was motion captured. It was the first motion captured film, entirely motion captured. So I was taken aback by the facial expressions. I didn't like the facial expressions. I thought they weren't done very well.
I thought they were variable, really variable. So sometimes it worked.
Yeah.
Sometimes the eyes were very, very glassy.
Very glassy, yeah.
And Santa was surprisingly wooden. He was the most wooden of all the characters.
Yeah. And so I wasn't really enjoying it. I found it slow. I was a bit bored.
Yeah.
But that changed. It really is amazing because it changed completely. I can't believe I ever felt that way because I am completely different now after watching it with my boy and how much we love it and how much, you know, I watched the beginning now and I love the beginning. You know, I found it boring back then, but I don't at all now. It's completely changed.
Well, let me give you a sneak preview to my score. Not the number, but yeah. I'm going to score this differently to how we usually do.
Okay.
I'm going to give it a score for watching on a big screen and then watching at home because I think so much of how you're going to enjoy this film will be on the context and if you're a parent or whatever. But I think it's also in whether it immerses you or not because of the way you see it. So if you're going to see this film and you've got a choice between big screen or small screen, this is one of those films where, go big screen because it's a ride. It really is.
It really is a ride. I mean, I hadn't seen it on the big screen. I saw it on the small, on a flat screen TV now. And but I went and saw it IMAX 3D only a week ago.
I think I saw it on a big screen, but not 3D or IMAX. But same thing.
It was stunning. It was amazing. And I think they've worked on, I think they've actually done a bit of a restoration of it because the facial expressions and everything were a little bit better than what I remember it. And I loved it even more. I thought this is just, and the whole ticket sequence in 3D and it's right in your face, you know, like it was stunning. I really loved it on the big screen. If you can see it in IMAX 3D, definitely do it. I think they bring it out every Christmas.
Well, the fact that it's, you know, an animated film lets them do a number of interesting things. You mentioned two of them. It lets them, you know, follow the ticket and the pin. It lets them do the rides, whether the rides are up and down the train track or skating across a frozen lake or even through the streetscapes of the North Pole at one stage on a runaway caboose. But the other interesting part, you mentioned how at the very start of the film he goes to his encyclopedia and they film him up through the pages.
That's right.
So the text is backwards and overlaid across him as he's, and you see him, you know, scouring this entry trying to work out about the North Pole. There were parts of this film I thought, oh, you know, this bit I think I would rather see as live action. And the one I guess I'm a bit conflicted about is the hot chocolate scene. I like it. I really loved it the first time I saw it, you know, and you've got all these acrobats, waiters flipping backwards and forwards
That's
with
right.
trays of hot chocolate and catching it. So nowadays you might be able to do that with CGI hot chocolate.
Yeah.
But sometimes in the film, and this was the place where I really noticed it, but there are a few places, the body movements weren't quite right.
That's right. Like
the backwards flips just were slightly off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that.
And I don't know if that's something they've revised more recently, but
I agree with that. Yeah, but
you know when it doesn't look quite right, and it kind of jars you a bit.
Mm. One thing I didn't know, and I was really surprised only just when I was just reading up on it again, and I've seen it a lot of times, and I didn't realize that Tom Hanks played the little boy.
Well, I got really confused about that because I was trying to work out. I know that
his voice doesn't sound like Tom Hanks at all. They must have done something digitally.
Oh well, no. In fact, the boy was, as I understand, was played in three different ways. So the voice of the boy is, if I've got this name right, Daryl Zabara, who's the redhead kid from Spy Kids.
Oh really? Does the voice? Oh right, okay.
The
that confused the hell out of me.
And he played, and I think the way it worked was that the body was played by two people. One was Tom Hanks at times, and the other was, I think his name's Josh Hutcherson, who's in The Hunger Games now.
Oh, right.
But he was a child actor then.
Yeah, okay.
Apparently, he recently came out and on one of those TV chat shows and told a story about how embarrassed he was when he broke wind at one stage of Tom Hanks and how lovely Tom Hanks was about the whole thing. Tom Hanks is, you know, the original nice guy.
Yeah,
you know?
That's right.
But I'm not entirely sure I got this right, but I think what was going on was that Hanks did some of the expressions, and maybe Josh Hutcherson was the boy when they're in physical scenes together. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, but it was broken up across three people.
Yeah, right.
But when I first saw it, I knew that because it looks like Tom Hanks. I knew the conductor was Tom Hanks. Mm. I knew that the ghost hobo who keeps reappearing was Tom Hanks because he looked like him and he sounded like him.
What an interesting character that is.
Yeah, and they explained him to a certain point, and then just like the magic of Santa, just let the rest of it just kind of hang there.
They do.
Yeah.
By the end of it, my boy picked it up. He's the ghost of the train. He's like the guardian.
The way he kind of dissolves into flurries of snow is a nice take
a few times.
I watched one of the deleted scenes. There was a song that was deleted. Michael Jette, who died during post-production, and the film's dedicated to him. If you know him, one of the places you might know him from is either Sister Act 2 as one of the monks or as Mr. Noodle from Elmo's World.
Mm-hmm.
Very physical kind of comedian. He plays both the train, the driver and the coal shoveler.
Yes, right.
He does the voices of both. What's not apparent, unless you watch this deleted scene, I think, is the fact that they're twins, which is revealed in a song that was cut, a song about the fact it takes two people and the fact that they work in unison.
Okay.
But in that deleted sequence, they tell the story in more detail of the hobo.
Oh,
and about
right.
what happened. So if you want to unpack that magic a little bit and know a bit more about the story of the hobo, that's if you get the DVD or whatever, you can see that sequence as well. Some of which was completely animated, some of which was partial in that way that they do.
Right, yeah, sure.
But I had no idea that he played the other six characters. So you mentioned the other four were the boy's father.
Yes.
The narrator, I think, is another one.
Mm-hmm.
Who were the other two?
Oh, that was Santa.
Oh, Santa, of course, yes. And the boy himself. And the boy.
And Scrooge.
Oh, and Scrooge, the puppet. Yeah, that's Scrooge's right, puppet. Yes. So, yeah, I had no idea that he's a versatile guy.
Yeah.
And he I think he's executive producer of the film.
Yeah, he would have been.
And he came to the project intending only to play the conductor, and then it kind of just blossomed.
Mm. Look, Robert Zemeckis is always good with technology. He always pushes technology. It's a bit like James Cameron pushes technology as well. He obviously loved the medium after doing Polar Express because he did Beowulf
and A Christmas
and
Carol.
And A Christmas Carol with Jim Carrey.
Have you seen those?
Yes, I have.
I haven't seen Beowulf. I've seen Christmas Carol.
I really liked Beowulf and I really liked Christmas Carol. I thought Jim Carrey's Christmas Carol was very good.
Yeah, I liked it. And I can be very ACDC about Jim Carrey. Like when he really overdoes it and mugs, he loses me very quickly. But he did well now, I agree.
He did. What did you think of the characters? The girl, the friend in it?
Oh, I thought it was beautifully done.
Mm.
So the girl who needs to develop confidence in herself.
Yes.
And the whole
that's
thing.
A lead, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Lead. And the whole thing about what the conductor punches on the tickets.
Oh, I love that.
So when they go to the North Pole, he does this very fancy, you know, tick, 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 kind of thing, where he punches out some letters, and two of them have B-E, and the other one is L-E, is it?
L-E.
Yeah. And then when they get on the train to go back pretty much at the end of the adventure, he does the other half of the word. So our hero, who I don't think is ever named, in fact, none of them are named except for the boy, the poor boy, the lonely boy.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, none of the other children are named, including the narrator. But his word is believe, her word is lead.
The know-it-all is learn.
Oh, so it was two BEs, yes, and one BE and two LEs. Mm. That's right, yes. So you get this revelation.
Mm.
And no, I thought it worked well. You have a know-it-all boy. Wasn't an absolute pain. It was a bit of a pain.
And the bell. The bell is beautiful.
Well, I haven't told you that part of the story when I first saw this. Mm. I was very taken with that. And so we would have seen that maybe a fortnight before Christmas.
Mm.
And I scoured the shops trying to find a silver bell for my older son. I wanted Santa to, because he would have been just under four, I wanted Santa to leave a silver bell for him in the same way the boy did. And I, you know, can you believe how hard it was to find a bell? And then I think it was my absolute last hour of shopping, I found this bell the size of a small soccer ball or something.
Yeah.
You know, not that big, but it was quite sizable. That had the sound. And that whole metaphor in the film of, while you hear the bell, you retain the magic. So his parents think it's broken. His younger sister hears it, but he says eventually she stops hearing it, and he always hears it. And there's a metaphor for, you know, carrying the magic in your heart of Christmas and what it's about. It was really nice. And so, yeah, I absolutely responded to that.
It moves me a lot.
Yeah.
When that finishes. And it's one of those movies which, it's one of my favourite Christmas films because it just gives me the spirit of Christmas.
Yeah.
It gives me that. When I watch it, suddenly Christmas is here and I feel amazing.
The other thing that really struck me this time around is that it's extremely skillful in its sound design.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got, you know, almost the obvious things like the song and dance numbers.
Yeah.
Such as Hot Chocolate. I find the song at the back of the train with the lonely boy.
When Christmas Comes to Town.
I find that very moving.
Oh, it's very moving.
I've forgotten how moved I was by it. And but there are other times when there was just silence.
Mm.
It wasn't a film that tried to fill every nook and cranny. Mm. It was quite masterful.
Mm.
And I think we've talked before, I don't necessarily tune into sound design.
Mm.
You know, I think very captured by story and visuals and characters. And if there are songs, you know, I'm up for a musical every time, pretty much, except maybe Dancer in the Dark from last season. Yeah, that's right. Anyway, moving right along.
No,
but
yeah.
Like a Polar Express. But this film, I really noticed how it moved in and out of sound and different sorts of sound. Well, I thought it was very well done.
I love the sounds of the train. When the train first arrives and you get an old thing, but when it comes at you, with the whole cow catcher at the very big the front of the train comes at you and you hear this little. I know what you mean.
Well, at this stage, I feel compelled to give a shout out to my dad, who might not want this known, but when I was growing up, Dad had a record, you know, an old LP, that was the complete sound recording of a particular train's journey. I can relate to that.
Yeah.
Hi, Dad.
Well, that's good to know.
So what are you going to give this film?
I'm giving it an 8 out of 10.
Yep.
I think because it was the very first motion captured film, I think some of the animation
Jars a bit sometimes.
Jars a little bit sometimes.
Once or twice, but I felt like the story was dominated by the technique.
Yeah. But in saying that, it does everything you want it to do.
Well, I'm going to give this different scores for big screen, little screen.
Mm-hmm.
Big screen, 8 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
At home, a 7. Because it's you still get the sense of the ride, but you know, you get the ride on the big screen.
You know, I'll agree with you on that one after I saw it in IMAX 3D. Absolutely. You know, now
you make me feel like I should go and do that now, actually.
You've got to. Now I watch it on the small screen, it's great, but it's nowhere near as good as that. That's pretty amazing.
Well, my younger son says he's watched this film once or twice before and was not interested in watching it with me again, but I wonder if I can lure him to a big screen.
So the second film we're going to talk about is Miracle on 34th Street.
This Christmas story has been filmed at least four times, so it definitely rates as a Christmas classic. Most recently, in 1994, with Sir Richard Attenborough's Kris Kringle, so probably about due for another remake. Twice for TV, in 1973 with Sebastian Cabot, and in the mid-1950s with Thomas Mitchell, who you might remember playing Uncle Billy in It's a Wonderful Life. And this original version in 1947, written and directed by George Seton, who has quite a varied career. He wrote and directed both The Country Girl, which I think won Grace Kelly an Oscar, and the original Airport movie. But in this film, Kris Kringle is played by Edmund Gwenn as an avuncular but clear-eyed Santa. He turns up at the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade to find their Santa is drunk. He tells the parade's coordinator, Doris Walker, played by Maureen O'Hara, and quickly becomes the new Santa so that the children won't be disappointed. He's very good at it. and goes on to become Macy's department store Santa. Chris is a natural, surprise, surprise, but causes trouble when he tells parents where they can find their child's heart's desire, even if it's not at Macy's. A young Natalie Wood plays Susan, Doris's 8 or 9 year old daughter. She's been raised by her mother to believe only in reality and is unfamiliar with even the most basic fairy tales. Chris brings imagination and fantasy into Susan's life, to the discomfort of her mother, but with the encouragement of Fred, Doris's suitor, John Payne. Meanwhile, Chris incurs the enmity of Macy's staff psychologist, Granville Sawyer, who diagnoses the Christmas spirit as a psychological illness. The story culminates in a trial where the court must decide whether Santa is real and whether he is truly among them, even though the court would far rather avoid these decisions about reality and belief. Ricardo, what did you think?
I haven't seen any version of Miracle on 34th Street bar this one.
Mm-hmm. Had you seen bits of it?
No, nothing.
I've seen bits of a couple of the versions, but I never watched it properly.
No, I didn't know much about it, to tell you the truth. I knew it was about this guy who was Santa. I didn't know much about it at all. I really liked the film.
You sound qualified.
Yeah. Look, I was a bit annoyed by the whole Macy's propaganda in it. Yeah, the whole Santa, oh, go to that store, go to that store. I was jarring a little bit.
Rather than Santa bringing the present to them?
To them. I found all that commercialism a bit much.
Yep.
Yeah, I was thinking about this.
But nice it's a Santa that objects to commercialism as well.
That's right. Yes, that's right.
Even though he tells parents to buy the stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, it's kind of odd.
It's a little bit odd. He was very good as the Santa.
I think he's really great in the part.
Yeah, so do I. And I really believe him. I really believe him. Natalie Wood is stunning.
Oh, she's very assured.
She's very good. Very good. I mean, I was just looking at the way she passed away and she drowned. I thought, what a waste. She died so young.
Yep.
And she was amazing even back then. Doris, I found it was great to see that there's this strong female character who's the worker. But I felt in doing that, they made her very sort of not in control. She was always very sort of on the edge. You know, she was in control. She was leading the whole parade and everything, but then she wasn't. And she was always, and something was always a bit wrong, or she needed that little bit more groundedness in the role.
I read a comment somewhere after I watched the film that spoke about this is a woman in a management position straight after World War II and all the men are coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can look at her character as being someone who actually is a bit out of control and doesn't want to offend anybody because the men have come back and can she retain her role?
That's so an interesting,
I think there's something in there.
Yeah, you're right. There is something in there, actually. Didn't even think about that.
Didn't want to demolish it.
No, you just did. In that.
Let me move swiftly on.
Yeah.
One of the things I find interesting about this, when we were planning this season, at one stage we were talking about the number of fantasy films around about 1947.
Mm.
And if we jump back to 1946, you've got It's a Wonderful Life. 1947, you've got films like The Ghost of Mrs. Muir, which I love, the Rex Harrison, Gene Tierney film, the original, The Bishop's Wife, that we'll have to do on Christmas, Cary Grant, David Niven, and maybe Loretta Young.
Mm-hmm.
You've got this film and other films that I think on the back of World War II are very strong on fantasy.
Mm.
And fantasy in the middle of our normal everyday life. The other one, A Matter of Life and Death with David Niven, which I love as well. This is a little bit different to those because even though it's Santa doesn't particularly do anything sort of magic or you know, twinkly. So he arranges things, like he arranges for people one way or another to get the gift that they want, even if that gift is a new home for their family. He it's quite clear he arranges that.
Mm.
But you can imagine if this film had been written for the first time, because I've watched bits of the remakes and they seem to be almost slavishly scene-for-scene copies. But you can imagine if this film was written for the first time now, they would go to the other extreme and that Santa would be doing little magic things, almost like I Dream of Jeannie or Bewitched.
That's right.
He
doesn't do anything.
I wanted a little bit more of that. I want a bit more magic to him.
Look,
but
the end shot is as magical as it gets.
Which is the end shot?
It's the cane in the corner of the room.
I thought you meant that, towards the end.
Because you think, oh, it's true. Because all the way through it, you're going, is he really or not? Or do you think?
But a normal man could have done that too.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, just had connections and so on.
Yes.
So it's never quite told to you whether he is or not.
No, but it's about the Christmas spirit and belief. And
yeah, it's quite clear that he is, but it doesn't sort of lay it on slavishly. You can doubt if you want to.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
In the context of the story. Mm. But so what was I'm a bit mixed about him. Like, I think Edmund Gwenn plays him perfectly, to a T. Mm. I just would have liked a little bit more sparkle in the story. But, I'm a sentimentalist.
Yeah.
Without parallel.
Well, it's what I found the sweetest in the movie was him bringing fantasy and belief to the girl.
I would say that was number of things.
And bringing her around to believing.
Yes, but I didn't know about the mailroom boy, the boy who also has to play Santa.
Yes, yeah.
Who becomes the crux of the situation that leads to the court trial because the psychologist tells him that he's compensating for something in his childhood. Mm. And Kris Kringle is saying, no, you just like bringing joy to other people and takes on the psychologist, which gets him in trouble himself. I thought that was quite lovely as well. And I think the film really hits its stride in the great courtroom scene.
Yeah,
it does. Reminiscent of films like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Mm. And in fact, since I watched Miracle on 34th Street, I watched for the first time Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, Gary Cooper.
Yeah, right.
Which culminates in a court trial as well about his sanity. Mm. I don't actually know what year that was, but there are parallels there too. And it really, the courtroom scene, the comedy could have been a bit lighter and made you laugh a bit more about the things going around the trial. Mm. So the fact that the judge doesn't want to get involved in this decision because it might affect his chances for re-election, which is an interesting insight because here in Australia, our officials aren't elected of the lines. It's quite different.
It's different, yeah.
But so the judge, is getting caught up in this and doesn't want to. The prosecutor finds himself in a bind because they bring his son in to testify about Santa.
That's right.
And there's not much he can say.
He can't say much.
So I find the storyline delightful. I just wanted a bit more in the execution.
Mm. With anything, with all movies, I want to be moved. And I think old movies, people say, oh, well, sometimes the older movies don't move you as much nowadays. But I think that's not true. I think It's a Wonderful Life moved me extremely.
Yeah, that is the benchmark.
This doesn't hit that. And it's nowhere near it, actually. Nowhere near it. It's still lovely and it's still...
It's got nice touches. The fact that on his personnel form, he's next to kin of the various reindeer.
Mm.
And the fact that the psychologist talking to his wife starts, picking at his eyebrows, and later his secretary comes in to say the wife's on the phone, and she starts picking at her eyebrows as well. Like there's touches, but it doesn't quite get there. It's not a Frank Capra film, for example.
No, but it doesn't do the one thing it should do, and that's make you feel like Christmassy.
Yeah. I go with that.
I didn't feel like at the end, Christmas. It was very bogged down in the whole belief of Santa and whether this guy was Santa or not.
He won Best Supporting Actor for that part.
Well, he deserves
Edmund
it.
Gwenn. Yeah, I think he did.
He deserves it. He was wonderful. He won the best part of it, yeah.
It won Best Screenplay, Best Original Story, and it was nominated for Best Picture and up against The Bishop's Wife, which I really like, but lost to Gentleman's Agreement, which won a few of the other awards. But I saw one of the extras on my DVD was his acceptance speech at the Oscars. And he basically just said, well, winning this award just proves to me that there is a Santa. And that was nicely done. Like, you get the feeling he was a really nice man.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he was good casting.
Mm.
So what do you want to give this film?
I'm giving it a 6 out of 10.
Ah, okay. Mm.
I know it's a classic, but I'm just going by what I felt when I was watching it. And it's enjoyable, and I think 6 is a good score. I'll probably see the remakes and see what they are like. Apparently the Richard Attenborough one's okay.
Apparently. The 73 one, the psychologist played by Roddy McDowall,
who's
doing classic Roddy McDowall from the bits that I saw. I don't think I bothered with that particular one, and I've only seen a couple of little snippets from the Thomas Mitchell one that was made about 8 years after this.
Yeah, right.
For me, it's a 7, and maybe it's a low 7.
Mm.
Like, I know exactly what you're talking about. Mm. I enjoyed it. I was pleased to finally have watched it properly rather than bits of it. Natalie Wood is great in her part.
She's
Edmund Gwenn is great in his part. The mother and the suitor, they're okay as characters. You could have done...
He reminded me of Jimmy Stewart sometimes.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, he did.
Well, Jimmy Stewart would have been very good in that part.
Well, I think they would have got him, if he had probably was available, they would have loved him in that role. I just thought, he's channeling Jimmy Stewart here. I bet you they just went, we want Jimmy Stewart, but we can't get Jimmy Stewart. We'll get a guy who looks like Jimmy Stewart a little bit, and can you play him a bit like Jimmy Stewart?
But again, the scenes when he moves in with the suitor, when Kris Kringle moves in, again, a lighter touch. They would have done more about the fact, almost the odd couple situation, or the fact he was a little bit magic or all-knowing or something.
Mm.
There were just all these opportunities I felt kept getting missed. So, look, it's a 7, I think, but I could teeter down a bit as well.
And they could have done that, because It's a Wonderful Life does that.
Yeah, and in fact, if someone's going to remake, if you're listening, if somebody wants to remake this film, don't do what I think the others have done, which is just almost just get the same script dusted off and then just film it again. Play with it a bit. Don't do the whole, you know, over Hollywoodization where it is, you know, I Dream of Jeannie, but it could be a lighter film.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think I'd like it more. Who would you cast as Santa now?
Oh, who would you cast?
It's Chris Kringle, I mean, but yeah.
I'd have to think about that.
Mind you, I've asked the question and I'm a bit stumped as well. I might come back to the end of the episode. And now for our third film for Christmas Season 3. Why don't you tell us about Gremlins, Ricardo?
Released in 1984, this comedy/horror film, directed by Joe Dante, begins with an inventor/salesman, Randall Hoyt Axton, looking for a present for his son, Billy, Zach Galligan. Trying to do business in Chinatown, Randall is shown a Mogwai, a fuzzy and cute creature that would be named in the film Gizmo. The shop owner is reluctant to selling the Mogwai, but the shop owner's grandson sells it to him for the money with a strong warning to never expose him to bright light, water, or to feed him after midnight. Billy loves the little Gizmo and takes these rules seriously until he accidentally spills water on him, and little baby Gizmos pop out of Gizmo's back, and from the outset, these little cheeky Mogwais are not as nice as our cute little friend. When a broken clock prompts Billy to feed the new Mogwais after midnight, they turn into gross cocoons overnight. Then they hatch, turning into ugly, mean-spirited, violent gremlins. Led by their leader, Stripe, they begin to attack Billy's mother, Lynn, Frances Lee McCain, who gets her own back on these little terrors. Now, it's the first time I ever saw a microwave used as a killing machine.
You need to get out more.
Well, this was like 1984.
Yep.
Stripe falls into a swimming pool, creating a huge gang of gremlins that then tear up the town on Christmas Eve. Now, sure, we meet town folk characters along the way, and Phoebe Cates makes for a nice love interest for Billy, but really it's the gremlins who are the showstoppers here. They are beautifully designed and operated. I think the puppetry in this film is some of the best ever seen on film. You fully believe these gremlins are real. Made today, there's no doubt that they would be computer-generated, and I think that's the real joy here, witnessing a lost art in mainstream film. Done this well, computer animation doesn't come close. This film should never be remade. Ever. Greg, what did you think?
Well, I'm not sure they should have made a sequel. And I know there's a bit of chatter out there, you know, on the net that maybe they're going to be making Gremlins 3 and, you know, quit while you're ahead, I think.
Yeah, don't. Don't.
I'd forgotten that this was a Christmas film. I saw it when it first came out back in 84, and I haven't seen it again until the last few days when I watched it at home. Yeah, so there was so much. I remembered moments from the film, and I remembered the three interdictions, you know, no bright light, no water, no feeding after midnight. I knew that general arc of the story.
Yeah.
But beyond that, it was moments I remembered and not the setting so much.
Yeah.
And I disagree with you. We meet characters, by which we meet people who fulfill functions in the story.
Of course.
One of the criticisms of the film is that there's not actually much in the way of character.
No, there's not.
Like Billy, you know, he's a good-looking, bland kind of guy, but there's not much to him. Phoebe Cates, not a lot more. There's that really weird story she tells about her father that feels totally tacked into achieve the theme that, you know, Christmas can be dark and not happy for everyone.
Yeah.
But I didn't, like, no one really was much more than a cipher or someone there to fulfill the story.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have problems with this film, but look, there's lots in here. And the thing that I don't know I picked up on so much last time that I really loved about this film is it is a film that itself is suffused with love for film, for movies. So,
It's a Wonderful Life.
Life, Wizard of Oz, you know, the meme which you, I'm going to get your little dog, you know, is there. Absolutely A Wonderful Life, you know, Mrs. Dreagle, you know, who's kind of the bad guy, apart from the gremlins, is obviously Mr. Potter from It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, but you've got also even the town looks like It's a Wonderful Life. The township.
Well, it's called Kingston Falls rather than Bedford Falls.
There we go. Yeah.
And it, just in case you weren't getting it, you get some scenes from It's a Wonderful Life playing on the mother's TV.
That's right.
And in fact, it was in those moments the first time I'd ever even heard of It's a Wonderful Life. That I think kind of led me to discovering that film, for which I'll always be grateful.
Yeah,
you and I both love that film. The small town USA is such almost a Spielberg kind of thing, and he's the producer on this film, I think.
Yeah, he is.
You know, it's like the small town in Back to the Future.
Yeah,
1, 2, and 3. But there's all these references to films and jokes about films. So you get. Oh, at least maybe half a dozen times you see scenes from films on someone's TV. So It's a Wonderful Life, the Clark Gable Barbara Stanwyck film about the mini races, the first Invasion of the Body Snatchers,
with
the pods, Snow White, the Seven Dwarfs, and where the Gremlins are all singing "Hi Ho" in the cinema, which is quite lovely actually. So you get all those kind of references throughout. You get the story kind of references like Wizard of Oz and It's a Wonderful Life, and then you get all these really interesting cameos. So some of the cameos are relatively obvious. So the shop owner is played by Key Luke, who was one of the sons, if not number one son, in the 1930s Mr. Chan movies, Cato in, I think, the first version of Green Hornet in 1940.
Oh, wow, okay.
And was also Dr. Yang, the herbalist, in Woody Allen's Alice. So he's done lots of things, particularly some of those older things. You've got the couple of scenes when the father, who's the inventor, is calling home from the convention, and there's lots going on around him. So Steven Spielberg goes past on a little kind of scooter thing.
Oh, I did not even
recognize
that.
With a TV screen. I had to be told, but then I went back and checked that he's watching Poltergeist. you've got the guy who was Zach Galligan's step body double. They're dressed up apparently like Joe Dante, the director. You've got Robbie the Robot going past. The bit that I really loved is that you have two scenes in that part. You've got the father at the convention on the phone booth.
Yeah, that's right.
Then it switches to whoever he's talking to at home, the mother or Billy, and then it goes back. And in the first part with him, you see the time machine from the H.G. Wells Rod Taylor film.
Yeah.
You have to go back and watch it. It's wonderful.
I have to watch it.
And someone's sitting in it and the back wheel is spinning like it does. It goes to the home shot. It comes back. There's like a puff of smoke and two people running around and the time machine with the guy and it's gone.
Oh, right.
Like, there's all this stuff going on.
Oh, I did not even notice a thing.
You've got, when you go to Mrs. Deagle's house, you see the portrait of her husband. That portrait is an actor called Edward Arnold, who had actually died almost 30 years prior. But he was in lots of old films, often playing corrupt tycoons, and was in fact in the 1938 film You Can't Take It With You.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And he didn't. He's moved, like, he's died, and his wife's got it all. So you've got all that kind of affection going on. You have a mention at one stage when the DJ is being attacked. You hear it through the radio, but he's talking before that about, you know, I'm tired of all this Orson Welles crap, which is a reference to his, you know, War of the Worlds Martian thing in the 30s.
Right.
And then you've got actors playing parts all the way through. So like Key Luke as the shop owner, the guy who has a cameo as Father Bartlett, the priest, you've seen him at the very start, and then you see him trying to post a letter and get him chucked out. Well, that actor is William Shallet, who I remember, I'm old enough to remember, just played the father and uncle character in the Paddy Duke show back in the 60s, and who played the ancient admiral in Get Smart. Do you remember the admiral?
Yes.
That's him. Oh, but now he really is old, playing the priest. So there's all these actors, you know, smattered all the way through it. So just the sheer affection that you see by the fact that they did that, and the joy they would have done, you know, experienced planning all that and executing it, makes it really something special.
There was a real love for cinema in this, and when you, even in the party sequences, when it gets very noir and one of the
in the bar.
In the bar.
That's why I got bored.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. No, well, I thought that was great, because I thought there was one of them smoking. It was like this really jazz bar sort of thing, and he shoots this thing. It's like, gets all gangster, and it got a bit silly. I mean, they do a bit of a, like, Olivia Newton-John sort of dancing.
No, it was Flash Dance.
Flash Dance, yes, it was Flash Dance.
Which came out 4 days prior.
That's right, it was Flash Dance.
So lots of, like, it references all the way through.
Yeah.
But that was the one bit where I thought, oh, this has got too slow. I think they're too caught up in what the Gremlins could do rather than kind of following the story through.
But how amazing is the puppetry, though?
Oh, absolutely. There was one sequence where they used stop motion, you know, when
there was,
after the pool and the wave come in.
Yeah, that's when you see all of the Gremlins together. together. That was, and you could tell that was stop motion.
Yeah, and apparently they were thinking originally of doing the whole film like that. It was just too expensive, so they turned their attention to puppetry, and you know, so much for the better.
Oh, absolutely.
That looks not quite right, actually.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. Yeah. But it's the only bit which looks a little bit clunky. The rest looks phenomenal.
Yes.
Yeah. The expressions. I find the gremlins quite hilarious because they're very intelligent creatures. They speak English. Gun and you
bright
know,
light,
yeah,
yeah. Or rather, bright
yeah,
light,
yeah. Oh, Gizmo, how cute is Gizmo?
Oh yeah, I know.
Gizmo is the cutest character.
But they've got really great talent doing the voices as well. Mm. So the voices were done by people like Frank Welker, who has been doing Scooby Doo and Fred from Scooby Doo for decades, well before Gremlins. They had the guy whose name escapes me, who does the voice for Optimus Prime.
They've got
really great voice talent, sometimes just doing, you know, background noise in the bar scene, where apparently they were drinking Budweiser to get in the mood. So they obviously had a lot of fun making the film as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's all very, very well done.
I'll tell you what, it's quite horrific.
Well, as I say, you called it a comedy horror film. That's exactly what I thought.
Yeah.
And I won't quite say that it doesn't hold back on the horror, but it goes a lot further than you would expect for what...
For a PG film?
Almost feels like a family film. But then it goes over the line.
Well, I think family films back then were a little bit worse than what we have it now. I mean...
You think we're more sanitised?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Poltergeist was a PG film when it came out. Poltergeist was PG rated.
Which I quite like it. We should do Poltergeist one
day. I like Poltergeist.
One and two, yeah.
And the end of this, when one of the gremlins dies, horrifically...
Is this the microwave?
No, the microwave is quite full on.
Well, they filmed that twice. The first time it was too much, so they filmed it again.
Oh, wow.
So I'm kind of curious to know what the first one was like.
Yeah. Oh, the second one was just, yeah, it was, I remember loving it. It was my favourite scene.
Do you mean how Stripe dies at the end?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
It's...
Which they did use in liquid nitrogen, apparently.
Oh, just horrific.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
My son won't watch that. There's no way.
Yeah.
You know, there's no way.
He's not quite eight.
He's not quite eight. Yeah. So there's no way he's going to watch that. He saw the cover and went, oh, that looks interesting. And I said, well, there's no way you're going to watch that one. Because I think it would give him nightmares. I think the horror in it is quite horrific.
How did you first see this film, the very first time?
Oh, it was on TV, video.
Oh, because I saw it in the cinemas, as I said.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. And I'd forgotten, but I remember now the scenes where the mother goes psycho in the kitchen.
I loved it.
You know, when she destroys one in the mixing bowl and then the microwave and whatever else she does. People were cheering and laughing. I remember that very clearly.
Yeah.
Like, it's horrific, but it does work in the context very much. And it is, at that moment, you are mixing quite nicely comedy and horror.
Yeah, well, the thing is, when I was doing the synopsis here, you're right about the characters in it because they're very thin.
And
gremlins are everything.
And I got a bit tired of, you know, the father's character is pretty much that he can't invent to save his life.
Oh, and I love the inventions. The inventions are hilarious.
Well, they are. And they've got their own inbuilt gremlins, basically. Yeah. But after a while, I got a little bit tired of that. Mm. But then it pays off well with the joke when he gives the ashtray to the old Chinese man at the end. And this film really, you know, it covers all the tropes of a horror film.
Mm.
So you've got the slow build-up of, you know, the source of the horror.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the hero who finds out. No one will believe him. He goes to the police. The police don't believe him. And then because they don't believe him almost, they get done.
Yeah.
And it's not clear sometimes which of the characters actually die or not.
I think all of them do.
Well, no, not the couple who get attacked by the snowplow.
They die.
No, they come back in the sequel. Apparently they escape.
Do they?
They were traumatised. He was particularly traumatised, apparently. Yeah.
Oh, I haven't seen this. I haven't seen the sequel.
No, I've watched little bits of it.
I think they've just brought them back. I think in
the intent was they had died.
They have died, yeah.
I think it's pretty clear the sheriff dies because one of the gremlins in the cinema is wearing his hat.
Yeah, right.
So... it is quite a violent film. There's that wonderful scene, which one of the things I think of straight away when I think of this film was the stair rail chair that gets...
Oh, it flies out
the top window and then it's just the feet.
Yes.
And actually, this just occurs to me now in this moment, but in some ways, the sheriff and a deputy see her when she's flown out of the window and all you see are kind of her feet hanging over to your chair.
That's right.
That's a little bit like the witch under the house at Wizard of Oz. At the start.
You're right, it is too.
I wonder if that's another reference.
Mm.
But the other thing is, you're watching the sheriff and his deputy who just sit in their car watching people being attacked by gremlins. They're not quite sure what it is yet, but they're sitting in the car and winding up the window.
That's right.
While this guy dressed as Santa, I mean, probably a central metaphor of the film, Santa being attacked by these horrible creatures.
Yeah, but
and they're just watching.
I can understand if it was a little bit further away, but it was quite odd because it was so close to the window and you could see the gremlins so well.
Yep.
Then they just weren't doing anything. No. And I just found that was a bit odd.
So whether they were in shock, but they had been pre-warned.
Yeah.
But, yeah, hadn't taken on board.
Mm.
What did you think about the story about Kate's father, Phoebe Kate's character's father? Because I remember that very clearly from seeing it as well. It just jarred with me both times.
Well, it comes out of nowhere. It really comes out of nowhere. She's...
Oh, you do hear her say that she does it twice. The first time she says...
She sets it up. She does set it up.
Well, everybody else is opening up their presence. Other people are opening up their wrists. Mm. You know, it's a pretty dark line.
It is,
but again, both times it felt like it's been put in. It didn't feel real or natural.
Well, it's
for the
coming
character.
Toward the end of the film. It's like there's only 15 minutes to go, and she brings this story up
out of nowhere.
Out of nowhere, which is trying to give you a bit more empathy towards her.
In a better film, it would give you more context for her character,
it's too late. It falls too late.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we're in the crux of the climax here.
I wonder how much was edited out, because you get the Judge Reinhold character, who's, you know, the painful guy.
He does not come back.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't get his comeuppance from the gremlins.
No.
Nothing happens.
And nothing.
Even the Divvery bank manager, Mr. Corbin, who's Edward Andrews, who's another face I just know from years of television and movies. Like, he's there, and then you don't see him again. Now, I don't mind so much that you don't see him again, because he's kind of background colour, but... Judge Reinhold is being set up, like Mrs. Deagle is, and even the sheriff and the deputy.
And you never see
them to be punished by the horror, and you don't see them. So I wonder, was something cut?
Yeah, it had to have been. Had to have been for Flo.
Do you know what happens in the sequel?
No. I want to watch it, so don't tell me, because I do want to see it.
Let me tell you two things that I don't think will spoil it.
Yeah.
The first is that there's a character who is apparently meant to be Donald Trump. His name is Daniel Clamp, and he's the... Yeah, the big businessman who owns this building where now Billy and Kate work. So it's shifted to New York.
Yeah, sure.
The second thing is there's a moment in it that if you don't know about it, I know you will love.
Mm.
So you and I both have a lot of respect for Leonard Malt, the American film critic, going back decades. Mm. He appears in Gremlins 2.
Oh, wow.
He has a little cameo where he's doing a film review, I think on Entertainment Tonight, and he gets attacked by the Gremlins. So even if you don't watch the film, find that on YouTube. That's a great little moment.
Did he give it a good review?
he apparently wasn't very kind about the first one.
Right.
And Dante said, will you be in the second one? He said, oh, okay, fine.
What are you going to give this, Greg?
Well, look, as I say, there's a lot to love in this. You know, just that affection and homage to films of the past and the genre, and even picking on the films that really celebrate that sentiment and joy of Christmas and the Christmas message, like It's a Wonderful Life, and then saying, now watch what we're going to do with that.
Yes, that's
right. That makes it very enjoyable. But I have a couple of slow spots, as I said. Yeah, the characters just weren't characters. They were kind of there to tell the story. So for me, it's a 7 again out of 10. You have to really respect a film that has a vision and goes all out to do it. Like, it's a very unique film. It picks up all those tropes and so on, but it really does its own thing with it. And so I really admire that. And I won't watch this film repeatedly. I say it's 30-something years since I last saw it, and I could wait another 20, 30 years to watch it again. But it's also one of those films where there are Easter eggs all through it. Now, I picked up on a lot of those, and I didn't mention that Chuck Jones makes an appearance.
Yeah, right.
When Billy is doing his cartoon early in the film, The Bar, and he's the guy to look at.
Yes.
That's Chuck Jones.
Oh, Chuck Jones, wow.
So, you know, there's things in there that I like knowing about and going back to see. But it's not a great film for me, no.
Well, I'm giving it a 7 as well. And that's an enjoyable 7. I really like this. I mean, I watched it all through my teenage years. I repeatedly watched it.
How many times have you watched it?
Oh, a lot when I was younger.
Okay.
A lot. It was one of those movies I watched over and over again. And I always loved the final line, you know, that you just might know there might be a gremlin in your house.
Oh, yes.
You know, I always loved that line. It was like, ooh, you know, check the bed, you know.
Spooky, spooky.
I really loved it. And so, but 7's a great score. I will watch the sequel. I haven't watched it yet, but I will watch it. I didn't think it really needed a sequel. That's why I don't think I've really gotten around
to it. Well, Joe Dante didn't either, but the merchandise has been so successful with Warner Brothers, they wouldn't take no for an answer.
Mm. So that's a 7 for me. So that concludes our Christmas special of season 3 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast.
We've taken you through 3 films going back 70 years until relatively recent past. And we hope across those 3 films we've given you food for thought, new insights into maybe old favourites, or even point you towards a film that you always meant to watch, like for us, Miracle on 34th Street.
That's right.
And never quite got around to.
Mm. So have you had a thought who could play Kris Kringle in a...
Oh, yes.
A new Miracle on 34th Street made today?
Well, in the moment, so, you know, with more thought, other ideas might come to mind, but I think the best I can come up with so far is Jim Broadbent. Now, I have seen him play Santa before in a film relatively recently, I think, called...
That's a good choice.
...Get Santa. Mm. I think he would do it really well. He had the nice touch of the groundedness and the whimsy, I think.
He could play that. Yeah. It's all about the eyes for me, so he's got nice eyes.
The eyes have it.
The eyes have it. So, I think it's all about that. So, yeah, it's a good choice.
Well, before we wrap up, and, you know, we've talked a bit about films that, you know, are traditions or have Christmas traditions in them, and it's becoming a tradition for us over the course of, you know, 3 years that I like to do something Christmas at the end.
You
it's
do?
Usually Christmas crackers.
Yes.
I've been away looking at this.
What have you got today?
Well, I've actually found that there are two types of Christmas crackers.
Okay.
So, Exhibit A is the traditional kind of Christmas cracker. Hold that.
Is right. We can do this one.
And
we
Exhibit B, so that's the tube with the two ends moving around each end of time.
Sure.
But there's this new one called Modern Christmas Crackers. How would you describe that?
That looks like a... you know what it looks like? It looks like a Sunny Boy.
Now, people overseas won't know what a Sunny Boy is.
Okay, Sunny Boy is an icicle block in the shape of like a 3D triangle.
it's like a kind of a pyramid almost.
A pyramid, yeah, that's right.
So the way this one works apparently, don't do it yet, is we grab an end each and they're kind of at right angles to each other and we'll pull it apart. So I thought what we could do is we could try the traditional and the modern and see how they work in terms of sound. Because, you know, in our first season it was an absolute dud.
Yeah.
We can try each of those, and then there's a special thing inside each of these for you and for I.
Okay.
You and for me, probably.
Yeah.
So let's start with the traditional. So this is our tube with the ribbons down the end.
This is not the triangle.
All right, you ready?
Hang on, I've got to grab the thing. Okay, I've got to go close to the microphone.
Yep, so this has got my thing inside of the case.
Has it? Okay.
Yep. Ready?
And one,
set,
two,
go.
Three. That wasn't bad.
Okay, so inside mine,
sure,
I've got the tape measure from Mary Poppins.
Okay.
And if I just check myself... Yeah, just like Mary Poppins, practically perfect in every way. So let's now try your one. Did you put that down somewhere?
It's perfect. Okay,
let's go. All right,
so... this one. Okay, so...
I have taken a photograph of the instructions because we can't quite work this out. Are you ready?
One, two, three, go.
I think that one was better, actually.
Yeah, that was a lot better.
Inside yours is this special jar of Ebenezer Scrooge bar humbugs.
This is actually, except for our listeners, this is actually full of fantails.
Well, overseas and people again won't know what a fantail is.
Well, a fantail is a chocolate caramel. A
very Australian lolly.
Yeah, well, it's chocolate and caramel. And you know what's so good about the fantails? It's got a lot of film history on it.
And guess games like Who Am I?
And they're always old. The information's always very old on the wrappers. Yeah. But, no, that's great. Thank you.
So we will leave our devoted listeners to enjoying your Christmas, hopefully. We're going to enjoy these chocolates.
Please have a safe Christmas and a happy New Year. We look forward to season 3, the first episode of season 3 in the new year.
We need you to be safe so you can come back and listen to us.
Of course. So until then, enjoy. Have a great Christmas.
And enjoy the ho-ho holiday season.
Again.